Now, I said simplistically that CB1 primarily in the brain, CB2 primarily in the immune system, but they're found in all organs, what I call cannabinotomy. You're going to find CB1 and CB2 receptors everywhere in all organ systems, and they act like a radar system. They're out there picking up signals, sensing what's going on at the cellular level, at the organ level, at the whole host level, because from a global perspective, your endocannabinoid system is all about maintaining health, well-being, balance, what we know as homeostasis. And so it picks up signals, it kind of responds and triggers off other compounds in the body and other receptors that are very important in regulatory mechanisms to adapt to stress. It's so much interesting data out there about the adaptation aspect of the endocannabinoid system that it's also part of evolution. DNA an analysis of even simple cell organisms, nematodes and things of that nature, show that this endocannabinoid system has been around for millions and millions of years as a point of not only helping the organism adapt, but to also evolve over those millions of years. We'll get there. Interestingly enough, they're all known as G protein receptor. The G protein receptors are ubiquitous in the body. Nevertheless, when you look at how anandamide or 2-AG hit these receptors, some of the things that we know we can regulate, like immunity and blood pressure and pain, inflammation, energy production, bone development, obviously neurological health, are all aspects of the kinds of responses you get from the various GPCR receptors that the cannabinoids hit. But they are quite promiscuous in that they also influence TRIP receptors, the 5-HT3, PPARs, GABA, on and on and on, all to, again, look at their regulatory role from a physiological standpoint in helping to regulate pain, inflammation, stress, anxiety, eye health, bone health, neurological health, insomnia, sleeping, things of that nature. So we know that the existence of and the importance from a global perspective is to maintain homeostasis, to be adaptogenic, to help the body natural response to stress, anxiety, pain, disease, and things. We know the ECS targets all organs, and there are many conditions associated with low levels of anandamide and 2-AG, our endocannabinoids that we produce. To get a glimpse of their functionality, here in CNS drugs in 2003, the location of receptors, especially in the central nervous system, even though it's all over the body, but to the left, but to the right, look at the functionality. Memory storage, motor function, posture balance, movement control, thermal regulation, neuroendocrine release, nociceptive pain signaling, immunity, bronchodilation in the lungs, intraocular pressure in the eye. The list from 2003 has gone on and on and on as we understand that the endocannabinoid system regulates neurotransmission, inflammatory cycling, pain signaling, insulin sensitivity, osteoclast and osteoblast activity. I mean, it just doesn't stop. So there's a whole host of what we know as ECS functional physiology, and from a neurological standpoint, both 2-AG and anandamide have been shown to be neuroprotective in their ability to lower inflammation in the brain, slow down activity in the brain, as well as increase antioxidant protection and reduce oxidative stress, some of the hallmarks of all neurological diseases. Here in Frontiers in Neuroscience, in 2017, how CB2 receptors, so we've always focused on the CB1 receptors, the dominant in the brain, whatever, but the CB2 receptors, when they analyzed brains for memory-challenged individuals, they saw an upregulation of CB2 receptors. Again, a message to us that it's trying to protect itself, and upregulation of a degrading enzyme. So modulating CB2 receptor signaling is useful as much as we have to pay attention to CB1 as well. Looking in the brain and looking at a very different area, we've seen two interesting papers. One here in 2003, and the next one I'll show quickly, neuropsychopharmacology in 2007. And that is to say, well, we look at the transporters for anandamide to be taken into the cell to be broken down by FA is significantly increased in women who have migraine headaches up against controls. Now we look at the cerebral spinal fluid, and on the other side we see significantly low anandamide levels in the cerebral spinal fluid of people who have chronic migraine headaches. So we know that there's a dysregulation in people with migraines to the endocannabinoid system, and how homeostasis is trying to be dealt with by upregulating CB2 receptor activity, and then we find out that these people are anandamide deficient. Here, targeting the endocannabinoid system to address stress-related challenges, another very important area. In the Journal of Basic Clinical Physiological Pharmacology 2016, they talked all about the preclinical and clinical data. Stress-related challenges that are associated with low endocannabinoid tone. So we are seeing, by measuring anandamide in the body, that when you get anandamide levels too low, they are significant positive indicators for stress-induced anxiety. Here was an interesting review paper in both animal models and healthy human volunteers, demonstrating an anti-anxiety effect of one of the phytocannabinoids, and even in patients with social clinical anxiety disorders. And then in Translational Psychiatry 2014, again, they actually measured anandamide levels and showed that when it gets too low, again, a statistically significant positive indicator for stress-induced anxiety. Again, how do you keep anandamide levels up to treat anxiety or migraines is to, just use one of these phytocannabinoids called CBD, but it's not the only story, there's 80 others. So supporting the endocannabinoid system is important to address a variety of these conditions. So what about inflammation that I spoke of? Well, there are papers and then there are papers. Here in Neurobiology of Disease in 2013, about how cannabidiol in viral models of multiple sclerosis has a significant anti-inflammatory effect. And then we look at a beautiful review paper in Current Opinion in Clinical Nutrition Metabolic Care, 2014, how the endocannabinoid system is an emerging key player in inflammation. So, while you think curcumin, boswellia, fish oils, quercetin are all powerful anti-inflammatory agents, well, agents that are affecting and supporting and nourishing the endocannabinoid system are going to blow those away, because it is the endocannabinoid system that controls these inflammatory pathways, whereas these other nutrients are kind of entering and influencing them in very different ways. The point of the story is you really need both, and phytocannabinoids make a wonderful adjunct to, or will set the stage to be the focal point of any nutritional protocol to address neurological diseases as well as inflammatory conditions. Well, if we fast forward here in 2017, you have interesting papers on cannabinoid system, the budding sources of targets for addressing inflammatory neuropathic pain, and then looking at endocannabinoids and pain, their sites and mechanism of action. Two excellent papers reviewing the fact that we know what we currently have in our arsenal to treat pain and inflammation has its limitations. You know, whether it be adverse effects, tolerance, dependence, GI problems, you name it. And that there are potent analgesic and anti-inflammatory effects of our endocannabinoids and in a variety of ways, by inhibiting pain pathways, reducing inflammatory signaling, as well as pain signaling to the brain. What about bones? Well, yes, we all have focused in on calcium, magnesium, menaquinone 7, vitamin D, silica, boron, all the other accessory nutrients, all well and good. But we know that when we face, especially postmenopausal women, and even in men as they get older, that hormonally, the things that truly help to treat osteoporosis is to influence osteoclasts, the cells that break down bone, and osteoblasts, the cells that build up bone. Well, lo and behold, in Journal of Neuroendocrinology 2008, how endocannabinoids help regulate bone metabolism in a variety of ways. Number one, when you activate CB1 receptors, it enhances this communication between brain-to-bone signaling, which occurs. It's like everything else in our body with these multiple organ communication systems, which I'll get to in a second. But secondly, when you activate the CB2 receptor, that stimulates osteoblasts and suppresses osteoclasts. So if you're treating any type of bone damage or even osteoporosis, you must use phytocannabinoids in your protocol to make this thing work effectively, because the others are more just for structural reasons. And then the interesting gut-brain immune system that we've all heard about, and why the endocannabinoid system is smack dab right in the middle. Well, in my very first book with a dear friend of mine, Dr. Jay Lombard, The Brain Wellness Plan, we wrote over 27 years ago, we have a whole chapter on the gut-brain immune connection. And it's become very popular as other books have come out. And it is this tri-directional communication between your gut, your immune system, and your brain. And it all hones in eventually, later on as we've learned, that the gut plays probably the primary role in this tri-directional communication. Why? Well, we know the gut is the primary organ of your immune system, and it's littered with all immune systems. And then we found out, as we go deeper, there are hundreds of millions of neurons found in the gut as well. Yes, your brain cells. So next time you have a gut feeling, you understand the gut is the second brain. So the gut has got both millions and millions of neurons, millions and millions of immune cells, and this is how we communicate primarily through the gut between our brain and immune system. You have to understand, during fetal stages of development, the cells that build the brain kind of branch off to build your intestinal tract, your gut, and it's all connected by the vagus nerve. And so there's a lot going on with these three organs. So what does this have to do with the endocannabinoid system? Well, right smack dab in the middle, the endocannabinoid system and also the endocannabidiome, the cannabinoids and their receptors, along with the microbiome, really set the stage of proper communication out of the gut with the brain and the immune system. Here in the Journal of Gastroenterology of 2016, the role of the endocannabinoid system and the brain-gut axis. We know that the endocannabinoid system regulates motility in the GI tract, controls emesis, it controls intestinal inflammation. We know that ECS has a role in inflammation, but in terms of the gut-related inflammatory diseases, Crohn's on down, ECS also links stress and the abdominal pathway through reducing the activity of the HPA pathway as well. Then we looked at some very interesting papers. Most recently, the endocannabinoid system acts as a regulator of immune homeostasis in the gut, and this is in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences 2017, and then Endocannabinoids in the Gut 2016 by a couple of very famous people who've been around in this sector for a long time, publishing a lot of good data. We know that anandamide plays roles in immune health in the gut. It regulates inflammation there as well and disrupts any issues that have to do with permeability or leaky gut. We know the ECS controls gas secretions and contractility, vagal neurotransmission, hunger signaling, and again, tolerance to foreign antigens along with the immune system. And the results of this paper, these papers have uncovered a major conversation that occurs between the immune and nervous systems and your endocannabinoid system and microbiome. So what are we getting to? Exactly what I started out, in that we are absolutely all connected. And taking this now from a organ and cellular point of view that I've been covering over the past 5-10 minutes, to the final paper that we got published in 2007 in the American Journal of Medicine about the global picture of the endocannabinoid system, and that it's all about maintaining balance in the body or homeostasis. Therefore, people have looked at the endocannabinoid system, again, as I mentioned before, as a system of recovery. It helps you relax, reduces pain, anxiety, modulates body temperature, hormone production, blood pressure, helps you rest. It inhibits excitatory behavior in the brain. It helps you forget. Excellent papers in post-traumatic stress disorder to extinct aversive memories. And it helps to protect at the cellular and emotional level. Doing all of this by governing certain important physiological functions like neurotransmission, pain signaling, insulin sensitivity, on and on and on. And because of this, when we all thought all about how endorphins provide the runner's high, well, we're going to have to change our thinking. Here in the Journal of Experimental Biology, changes in anandamide levels before and after significant treadmill exercise, both in humans, dogs, and even ferrets. And as we see after, in the black bars, the levels of anandamide go sky high. We got to turn around to understand that anandamide just doesn't touch the CB1 receptors, that they are also influential in the opioid and endorphin receptors as well. And that when we look at positive correlations between positive feelings and anandamide levels, the higher they go up, the more euphoric people feel. So the runner's high is due to endocannabinoids, not endorphins. Interestingly enough, there's other interesting papers that have to do with environmental and other modalities to increase, support, or nourish our endocannabinoid system. And here are two papers, one of my favorite subjects, using acupuncture points. Certain acupuncture points will absolutely increase opioid and endorphin output through its regulatory role in influencing endocannabinoid signaling for these receptors. So these are interesting papers for those of you involved in electroacupuncture. You can absolutely influence the endocannabinoid system this way as well, which ties into a nice paper in PLOS One about the care and feeding of your endocannabinoid system and how it has potential clinical applications. And then finally, one of my favorite subjects, the ECS and consciousness. Now, we could look at consciousness in a variety of ways. There are classical ways of one's person's awareness of everything that's going on around them, their thoughts, their feelings, their perceptions. All of that lends itself to awareness and consciousness. And then you look at the neuroscientist's point of view about the potentials that are going on, action potentials in neurons that are specific to perception, memory, and what have you. Well, when we look at interesting data in especially people who are stress challenged with post-traumatic stress disorders, there are several papers, but this one was an interesting one because it looked at preliminary studies of how it decreases post-traumatic stress disorder by extincting memories, nightmares, traumatic memories. So we know that the endocannabinoid system is affecting parts of the brain involved in memory, emotions, awareness. And we also looked at some papers here in CNS Neurological Discordant Drugs, 2017, about how the endocannabinoid system can modulate consciousness, emotions, and likely dreams. And they talk all about how, since the endocannabinoid system is a system of homeostasis, since from a neurological standpoint, it's regulating neurotransmission and affecting various parts of the brain involved in consciousness, cognition, learning, memory, what have you. And we know in post-traumatic stress disorder patients, we can extinct certain dream states and aversive memories, that the level of consciousness, which is constantly shifting, is absolutely influenced in one way, shape, or form by the endocannabinoid system. And then there was this interesting paper in Journal of Clinical Investigation of looking at the fact that consciousness can be defined not only by awareness, but arousal out of unconscious states. So when you put someone under anesthesia, you can consider them somewhat of an unconscious state, and return of arousal after anesthesia was influenced by blocking endocannabinoid signaling. So we now know deep down inside that every conscious thought, perception, or feeling is influenced in one way, shape, or form by the endocannabinoids, and in subtle ways, the endocannabinoid system is involved in developing personality, you know, the way you think, the way you focus, if you're relaxed, if you're under a lot of stress, what have you, its regulatory roles, and that the endocannabinoid system truly is a reflection of you. So now that I've given you a brief glimpse, because I could talk about this for the next 4 hours, of the importance of the endocannabinoid system in the body, from the cellular level, from the physiological level at the organ systems, and from the global level of the host itself. And so, to nourish the endocannabinoid system properly, we have to talk about hemp. And a quote by one of the godfathers of the endocannabinoid system discovery: by using a plant that's been around for thousands of years with immense physiological importance, we would not have been able to get there if we haven't studied this plant. In order to understand the ECS and how to nourish it, we have to talk about a plant that gets very confused with another plant. They are both the same genus and species, Cannabis sativa, and that's where the similarity ends. Hemp has been cultivated for many different reasons. Parts of the plant, especially the flowers and the stems, we find this class of compounds called phytocannabinoids. Nevertheless, we see it even in the mass market journals, in Newsweek here, Woman in Weed, it talks more about the hemp. And then you've got new magazines that come out today, like Hemp Today, what have you, all extolling the benefits and importance of hemp. Now you have to understand, hemp has been around a long, long time. The point of the matter is, hemp is an agricultural powerhouse. Why? Well, those of us in botanical medicine will know that there's a lot more in a plant than just one single compound. And I just made the case for the ginsenosides, the echinaceosides, the ginkgolides, on and on, the curcuminoids, as a class of compounds being important in individuals. Well, this entourage effect was beautifully written about at the British Journal of Pharmacology 2011 by Dr. Ethan Russo, who talked about the entourage effects. Having to have all the phytocannabinoids present and their terpenes to give full clinical meaningful benefit. So we now are looking for products out in the marketplace that have multi-spectrum or full-spectrum oils. Even Dr. Raphael Michalem and many others talk all about the type of synergism that's held in plants that, and in some cases, the plants are better than natural products that are isolated from them. By the way, even though I tell people you're going to have to get over the fact that you produce cannabinoids and feed off them and can't be healthy without them, I also tell them, guess what, you've been eating them as well. Carrots, hops, chocolate, echinacea, clove, pepper, thyme, rosemary, marjoram, all have minute levels of phytocannabinoids in them. So can you really benefit from them? Well, yeah, if you took in bushel loads of them, you can probably get clinical effects. Or if you can isolate some of them from these plants, which is not necessarily economical, except for cloves and peppers. But the richest source are the phytocannabinoids that are derived from hemp, and now also out of clove and pepper, where we can pull out beta-caryophyllene in higher amounts, which I'll talk about in a second. Like everything else in the body, there are times we don't produce enough. And it's no different here when people who have endocannabinoid deficiency states, they're not producing enough anandamide or 2-AG. So what do? Well, we know in various papers here in Neuroendocrinology Letters of 2014, 2008, where endocannabinoid deficiencies play major roles in migraines, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, inflammatory and neurological conditions that could be suitably treated using dietary cannabinoids. And then I show this paper again, how we can actually measure these cannabinoids, that if we can upregulate them or support them or eat them in the diet, how they became a primary target to treat certain illnesses by increasing their levels. And then we also saw the data about how statistically significant differences in cerebrospinal fluid and blood of anandamide levels in people who have migraine headaches or are under a lot of stress. And then finally, we look at this intimate, interesting relationship between your endocannabinoid system and omega-3s. And what have we found out? We have found out that people who are omega-3 deficient, their endocannabinoid system will suffer as well. Why? If you are omega-3 deficient, the endocannabinoid receptors are not as active, and these omega-3s and phospholipids that they are used as backbone structures to produce endocannabinoids in the body. Here in a variety of papers in Lipids 2017 and Natural Neurosciences in 2011, how they all talk about the importance between endocannabinoid production and omega-3 states. Here, even in the Journal of Pain, talk about how low levels of omega-3s are linked to the same things we see in people who are endocannabinoid deficient: pain, inflammation, anxiety, stress, on and on and on. And this paper talked about improving the altered omega-3 to omega-6 levels that influence omega-3-derived cannabinoids in the body. Potential effects of endocannabinoid deficiency in the brain: headaches, insomnia, anxiety, stress, depression, in the eye, glaucoma, in the GI tract, all the inflammatory conditions, in bone density, in the heart, and in other parts of the body that are affected by inflammation. So when we look at categories of where we can be influential by providing cannabinoids to our patients, we look at the fact that chronic pain, inflammatory conditions, anxiety, stress, insomnia are at the top of the list. And I stop there for a second, because these four categories literally affect every human being walking the planet. Then we look at the fact that it affects the eye. You have an independent endocannabinoid system in the eye. Bone health, I talked about the studies in osteoclast, neurological disorders. We've seen the data from Sanjay Gupta to the patent that he has given on, to all the data that's out there. And then diabetes and cardiovascular disease, because of two things. Number one, the ECS's role in inflammation, and secondly, its role in regulating insulin sensitivity, both of which have a role in diabetes and cardiovascular disease. In terms of safety, there are several papers out. This is the older one, 2011, one was just produced, saying the same thing. It really is very safe, very safe. There are some interesting effects that occur at high doses, and that it inhibits the cytochrome P450 enzyme. So patients on medications, if you give high doses, you may want to be considerate of either adjusting the dose of the medication accordingly. The new thinking amongst a lot of clinicians: you don't need a lot. There's a biphasic response. When you give too much, it kind of doesn't have much of an effect. And so low doses, 10 milligrams seems to be a sweet spot for most people, maybe up to 25 if you want to get therapeutic, is all you need, providing you're providing other phytocannabinoids that are complementary to CBD, as well as synergistic ingredients depending upon what you're trying to treat. So what about the lowly CB2 receptor? I say lowly, but it has tremendous effects in the body, in inflammatory signaling in the cell, pain signaling to the brain, insulin sensitivity, bone building. Any questions?